From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, we'll find out why the U.S. Navy is important to Milwaukee business. Later, changes to the GED test are raising concerns among some in Milwaukee.
It's going to take more higher order thinking. So basically, for example, in the math test, you're going to have to be able to write an equation. So that's something that's a lot different. Before, it was just multiple choice.
The facelift is complete on the last remaining iron building in Wisconsin. And Milwaukee author Jenny Benjamin tries to capture the essence of an 18th century Italian peasant.
Anyone, I think, who writes, that's part of the process, is that you do whatever you can to really get in the shoes of someone that you're writing about. Whenever I did research or whenever I was imagining him in situations, I became him.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. It's nice to have you listening this morning. The U.S. Navy is charged with the defense of U.S. interests at sea. And so, naturally, the cities that are most impacted by the Navy's presence are along America's coastlines, places like San Diego, Norfolk, Virginia, and Honolulu. But a high-ranking Navy leader is in Milwaukee today to meet with community and business leaders and try to get the message across that what the Navy does also has a significant impact on the economy of Milwaukee and Wisconsin at large. Rear Admiral D. Mewborn is commander of the Naval Service Training Command. He joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North in the studio today and explained his take on the role the Navy plays in U.S. and global commerce.
Well, I think that an understanding of the Navy, right, is to understand that we have a global reach. Our mission is to be out and to have that presence. What I think the greatest thing that we do in terms of the commerce here at Milwaukee and really for the globe is to make sure that that we keep the sea lanes of communication open, that we keep the trade moving, the global commerce happening. With 70% of the ocean of the earth covered in ocean, then you can kind of see why that it really the superhighways of the world are lie on the ocean. And the Navy's principal mission is to make sure that that we have that forward presence to take to keep those sea lanes free and all the trades moving. For Milwaukee directly, then I would say that understanding that there's a large engineering and manufacturing infrastructure here with a global market, that we would want to make sure that all goods and services can continue to flow, and the Navy feels very responsible for that mission, not only to the people of Milwaukee, but to the citizens of our country and to our coalition partners and friends around the world.
Have you found in talking with people today so far that business leaders are somewhat surprised that the Navy plays that kind of a mission?
I don't think they were surprised. I don't. I think that they were I talked this morning to the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce. I had a fantastic engagement with about 20 or so of the community leaders this morning. They showed just great warmth, hospitality, and a high level of understanding of what not only the Navy's mission was, but the mission of their military. A lot of them, as I went around the room and they were introducing themselves, a lot of them had military experience or they had some sort of military connection. And I think over the past 12 years or so of this war on terror, that all of America has a very heightened sense of understanding of what their military has done for them. They were all very appreciative of the military and thanked me, each and every one, for service, even though many of them themselves had served. So I got the feeling that they had a really strong sense of what the Navy did, of its value. And one question was even, what could I do more? What could we do here as citizens of Milwaukee to help the Navy and the Navy's mission? So I'm very appreciative of the strong support from the people of Milwaukee.
So what do you see specifically as the kind of partnerships that you'd like to create with business leaders and government leaders here in Milwaukee that aren't already established?
I think that a great question. And I I don't know exactly where we can go to form other partnerships per se. The ones that we have here, I think we should continue to foster. For example, you know, at Marquette University, we have an ROTC unit. And so there's midshipmen that are going to that school right now, and then within 4 years or so, you know, that's the length of the program, those students will matriculate into being commissioned officers in our Navy Marine Corps. So I think that if we can have business leaders that could provide mentorship to those midshipmen, that's a fantastic way that we can have a partnership between Milwaukee and the Navy. The other, of course, is through there's many firms that here in the local area that provide goods and services that to our military, the Navy, one of the services included. And so to continue to strengthen those relationships, you know, is something that should be looked at. There were some people talking to me about, they know that I run the Great Lakes area and the boot camp down there, and they were saying, gosh, I wish we could have more sailors coming up here, you know, to visit, to see the city, and to have experience their liberty up here. And that's something I'm going to take back and look at, seeing if we can't do a better job at either advertising or providing transportation or something so that they can come up and see Milwaukee for themselves. So we'll continue to look for ways in which we can strengthen the ties between the Navy and Milwaukee. But I can tell you that I know that from the little bit I've been here already today, that there is a strong sense of a strong sense of relationship between the military and the people up here.
Have you found running the boot camp and training the next generation of sailors, has there been a shift in making sure they understand that this is part of the Navy's mission, as opposed to it being purely a fighting force, as opposed to thinking of it as an armed service, not a necessarily commercial one?
Well, I think that, you know, the Navy understands the mission. Our mission set really ranges from everything from humanitarian assistance to disaster relief all the way through the full spectrum of combat operations. We pride ourselves in the forward presence of always being out there. We recognize that the Navy is always on watch, that we have right now about 100 ships will be deployed in aggregate and on average any time, any day. That somewhere around 50,000 men and women are out on deployment, and so they certainly understand that their missions range across a spectrum. We whether it's to assure our allies or to defend the homeland, or whether it's to keep those sea lanes of communication open so world trade continues to flourish, or whether it's if necessary to go and defend our nation, to win our nation's wars, we prepare our sailors for all, for the mission set that I described. And I think that, all of the sailors that come in, they come from all parts of the country. They represent all of our American values and our ideals. They certainly are, I think, if you had a chance to see what I get to see every day, you would recognize that America is in great hands, that the future of this country that I get to see, they want to serve. They want to serve in all those missions that I mentioned, and that they represent wonderful communities like Milwaukee in that service. So I'm not exactly sure how the if there's a direct feeling of how they need to relate to the community, but I can tell you this, that that their pride for their various communities they come from, their pride for their states and the sense of nationalism that they all have is exceedingly strong.
What about looking at contracts, like having the Navy? I know we already have some shipbuilding contracts further north up on Lake Michigan, and those are literal ships that are being built here. And is there a push from the Navy to look at maybe finding more contracts in Wisconsin that could be beneficial to both business here and to the Navy?
You know, I guess I can't answer that. I just don't know the answer to it. I'm not in, you know, the part of the Navy that I operate really is in the accession business. I run 98% of all the accession sources for the Navy, everything but the Naval Academy. So when you think of boot camp or ROTC, JROTC, and the Officer Candidate School, that's my the current
portfolio. So your personnel more than than things.
So more the human capital side of the Navy is what I would say, and less of the hardware and manufacturing and production and things like that that maybe was the question. I would say, though, in my experience, right, that and even in my personal life, where my wife is from Wisconsin, all her side of the family is from Wisconsin, that there's clearly a strong sense of nationalism here within the state. There is unbelievable talent here within the state, and I think the Navy recognizes that, through the building of the Littoral Combat Ship and other affiliations that we have through businesses in Wisconsin. Would the Navy always be interested in looking for new ties? I would say absolutely. And we're a very high-tech Navy, and we're pushing innovation. We're and looking for ways to advance our warfighting. And if there's companies here that is what they're seeking also, then it's probably good partnerships in the future that could be made.
Speaking, though, of that human capital that you are responsible for, how is recruiting? How are people responding in the United States, both for the Navy specifically, but just sort of overall?
Well, we continue to make all of our accession goals right now that when we have for many, many years. I think that, again, is really a testament not to recruiting as much as it is to the people of our great country. Every single recruit and officer candidate, midshipman that I meet, every single one has come in with an agenda. It's an all-volunteer force. And so I'll ask them, I'll say, why did you join? Why are you here? And they come with all different reasons. They want to serve their country. They want to follow in the footsteps of, a parent or a friend. They want to make a difference with their lives is one of the biggest answers I get. They want to seek education. They want to learn a trade. Every single one comes in with something that they're seeking. And so because I think we have such a wonderful service in the Navy that they see such great opportunity to advance their own personal agenda and to feel that sense of service that they come in. And again, I give the credit to, the moms and dads out there that have ingrained in these young citizens, that sense of selflessness and service. And as long as I think of that as spirit of Americanism is alive and well, we'll continue to have wonderful people filling, all ranks of our services.
Well, Admiral, I want to thank you so much for taking time out of a very busy schedule to stop by and talk with us today. I appreciate your time.
Well, it was really a pleasure. Thank you very much. And to all the folks of Milwaukee, I just want to say thank you for the great hospitality today to me personally. But more importantly, thanks for all that you do for our Navy. And I really do appreciate the sons and daughters that you have given to our service. And I just I wish that you could get to see through my eyes each and every day, and you would know how wonderful that America is in great hands. Thank you.
Rear Admiral D. Mewbourne is commander of the U.S. Naval Service Training Command. He's in Milwaukee today to talk with business and community leaders about the Navy's role in Milwaukee commerce, a trip that includes meetings with the MMAC, Johnson Controls, and Port of Milwaukee representatives. He spoke with Bonnie North. A short break now, and in just a moment, why changes to the GED tests are going to have a significant impact on some people in Milwaukee, and why that impact is raising some concerns. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. Major changes are on the way for the series of tests known as the GED, or General Educational Development Tests. These are the tests taken by people who have left high school without receiving a diploma. The material covered on those tests is designed to be roughly equivalent to what students are supposed to learn while they're in high school, and they make it possible for students without diplomas in many cases to go on to college. But as part of its usual review process, the test is undergoing a transformation early next year, and not only will that have an impact on future students taking the test, but it also stands to affect people who have passed some but not all of the current GED tests. Edgar Mendez reported on the issue for the online Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, and he's with us to explain what has some people concerned. Welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me again, Mitch.
Why are the GED tests changing?
Well, they last changed in 2002, so about every 10 years or so, they revamp it. This one's going to be more in line with what employers are looking for nowadays, which, you know, people need to be a little bit computer savvy now.
Who makes the changes? Who decided that this was going to be the way it goes?
Well, it was a decision that was made nationally. It's basically the people that are administrating the GED. They go through testing services and they contract it out to create a whole new test.
Well, and what can you tell us about how the tests are going to be different?
Well, it's going to go from 5 tests to 4. So those 4 tests are going to be language arts, mathematical reasoning, science, and social studies. And before it was reading, writing, math, science, and social studies. But the difference is it's going to take more higher order thinking. So basically, for example, in the math test, you're going to have to be able to write an equation. So that's something that's a lot different. Before it was just multiple choice.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but these are going to be tougher tests.
Right.
And the changes have been in the works for a while, right?
Right. They've known about it for the year. All the GED classes have been informing students for about a year now, or since the beginning of the year, I should say.
But the rub, I gather, is that there are going to be impacts on people who have passed some but not all of the current tests. What's the issue?
Right. Well, there's 2,800 people here in Milwaukee that have passed some of the tests but not all. So they have to basically get scheduled as soon as possible because they have to have them by December 13th for it to be valid, or else they start over.
Really? So they could have passed 4 out of the 5 tests, and then when they take the 5th test, if they don't pass it, they have to start over?
Right. Start over from scratch.
If the changes have been in the works for a while, what is the concern? Is the game changing midstream?
Well, I mean, the concern is for a lot of the students that I talk to, a lot of them aren't very computer savvy. So there's some trepidation there.
And I gather from your article, originally they thought they would have longer to pass these tests, right?
Right. Well, you know, people assume that you have forever to take them. I remember taking mines in 2003, and if I hadn't finished them, I'd still be able to finish them now.
So you say 2,800 people are in this boat. What is the impact on them right now and on the organizations that work with people studying for the GEDs?
Well, the hard part is reaching those 2,800 people. I mean, you can't look them up by address. So basically, you have to hope that they come in looking for their GED or that they find out some other way, maybe through this article.
So there's some expectation that maybe they go in to take another GED test after the first of the year and find out suddenly that they're taking a new test and that they have to take all the parts of that test?
Right. I mean, well, there's hope that people even realize that they're going to lose all their progress. I mean, most people don't know. Even a student I spoke to didn't know, but they had just came into class that week. So they were kind of taken aback.
So that was going to be my question. This was news to some of the people that you spoke with for this article?
Well, more at the YWCA. At Journey House, it's part of the orientation. So Journey House stopped taking people who weren't at least at a 9th grade reading level for their Spanish GED classes because they knew that if they came in with less than that, they wouldn't have enough time to prepare them to pass the test.
So this is obviously causing some real concerns over the people, not just the people taking the test, but the people preparing the people to take the test.
Oh, definitely. I mean, Jack Forbes, he's at Journey House, and he's had to turn people away, and he said, you know, it's hard to sit them down and say, look, I'm sorry, but you're just better off waiting until the next year. And that, he said that's hard to do, and it's hard to tell people that because, you know, that's discouraging. They're coming in there to improve their lives, and they're basically being told, not the time.
This does not mean, though, that they shouldn't start studying.
Right, definitely. Well, I mean, the thing is the new test, the new pretest materials, the practice materials aren't out yet for the new test. So those are coming out around the new year, too. So it's going to kind of put people behind the curve.
So you're really not able to do too much to study for the new GEDs. And so, as you say, there are people for whom instead of studying for the current GEDs, they're just going to play a waiting game.
Right. I mean, basically, you'd be studying for something that's not even going to be on the test. So it's going to be so different that it probably wouldn't do you any good.
Are there going to be cost differences between the past tests and what's coming?
Definitely. The price is doubling in a lot of cases. A lot of people are paying $65, $80. I think at Journey House, they have to pay $80. I think through some programs, the YWCA, for example, is free for people who go through their prep program. So it's going to cost $137 now.
So there are not going to necessarily be those opportunities to take the test for free through the same programs.
Well, I mean, the YWCA, they don't know what they're going to do yet as far as how they're going to be paying for it. They don't know how what the computer is. They're getting a new computer lab, so they should be fine on that. But I mean, like Journey House, the Spanish GED lab only has one computer. So they don't know what they're going to do yet.
So anyway, you slice it, there are going to be some big changes coming as far as GEDs go in the next 6 months.
Definitely.
So we've heard a lot of the negatives. What about the flip side of the coin? There must be a positive spin to the changes to the GED tests that are coming around. Tell us about some of those.
One of the things that makes the test, that improves the test is that it offers unofficial test scores instantly. Before, you had to wait in the mail. You had to play a waiting game. And also, there's an enhanced test score, which helps test takers learn their strengths and weaknesses should they have not passed the test and they need to go for a retest. And also, it also has a framework through the enhanced test score to determine job, workforce training, or post-secondary education readiness.
So the story here is that there are big changes and they could have a troubling impact on some people. But at the end of the day, the people who are designing the test and people who are using the test would probably counter that the test will be better as well.
Right. I mean, a lot has changed since 2002.
All right. Edgar Mendez, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Edgar Mendez reported on changes to the General Educational Development, or GED, tests for the online Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. There's a link to his article from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. We'll take another break now, but in just a moment, the architect in charge of restoring Milwaukee's Iron Block Building shares the story of what challenges were in that remarkable renovation project. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. The view out the window of the Lake Effect bungalow is a bit different now than it had been for the past year or so. The iconic iron block building right across the street from us had been draped in plastic and scaffolding, but it's now restored to a condition that it hasn't seen in decades. The exterior renovations, the interior work is next, took place as a result of the building's latest owners, the Wisconsin-based dental practice Dental Associates. Mark Dembski is the company's in-house architect, and he oversaw the iron block renovation project. He joins us in the Lake Effect studio to talk about the process. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
What was so significant about the iron block building that you went to such great lengths to restore it?
Well, the fact that it's the last cast iron building in the state of Wisconsin was very intriguing to us. Dr. Manos, who owns Dental Associates, is very much a design aficionado, and I think this building was too good to pass up, quite honestly. It's very unique. There's no other building like it. Because it came from the foundry that it did, the fact that it's on a corner, the fact that it's 5 stories tall, there's so many unique aspects to it that really made us want to use this building as our corporate headquarters.
Was there ever a point at which cast iron buildings were common?
Mid-1800s or so. So at the height of the Industrial Revolution, it was an easy way to get the look of a cut stone building without all the expense of having masons working on it for months and months. You could pump out these columns out of a foundry fairly quickly.
Once you got the notion that this was a building that was worth restoring, you must have assessed the kind of condition that it was in order to take it on.
We knew it was in bad shape, and we didn't know the extent, though, quite honestly, of it until really the sandblasting had started. You could look at portions of it, and they seem fine. One example would be this third floor corner here, which has about 8-foot run along Wisconsin and 8-foot run on water, that during the sandblasting process we discovered it was made out of fiberglass. So the decision was made to remove the corner completely and to recast it all in cast iron to be consistent with the rest of the facade. So that was something that we didn't know, you know, in the process of evaluating the building. And we ran into multitudes of those. Either something was missing or rusted out or a piece was not what it was supposed to be made of. Everything had to be removed first, and then we went backward. So,
well, and given that there are not a lot, not any more buildings like this in Wisconsin, right, there can't be a lot of precedent that you were able to call on in order to restore it. You can't say, well, they restored the other iron block building over here like this, so right, so we'll do that. What, were you working?
There was a little bit of that with there's a sister building in New York, the Carey Building, that was renovated, not to the extent that this one was, but we did rely on them for some of the color direction. When this building was renovated in the 1980s, all of the paint was sandblasted off. We had no historical evidence of what the color was. The thinking on our part was that since James Martin went to New York to see the Carey Building before this was built, that he probably liked the color of the Carey Building as well as the forms and the different pieces from it, because they used a lot of the same molds. So their historical paint analysis gave us the direction for the lighter color up above. Other than that, it was a lot of looking at photographs. We do have access to the original drawings of the facade, which are pen and ink drawings. They're absolutely beautiful.
But everything's in black and white. That was
everything's in black and white.
You have lots of photographic evidence, right, but nothing in color.
It's very true. Everything we had to look at was sort of shades of gray, if you will, on the facade. And we could tell some of the polychromatic nature of the paint scheme based on, you know, what it looked like in black and white. We did find a little evidence of the ground floor color that was still left on a couple of pieces that were left on the building all the way through and should have been removed. They were added in probably the 1950s, and it obscured some original ground floor paint. So that's what we used to determine what the color of the ground floor was. But everything else was looking at photographs. It was blowing up photographs and tracing and looking at other precedent. There is a catalog of the Daniel Badger parts. Not all the parts that were on the iron block are in here. This was published in 1865. But it was a way for building designers and owners to actually thumb through and select different portions of a building. So we use that pretty extensively, too, to influence how we put the building together again.
What are the kinds of businesses that have been in that building in the past?
There's been a lot of creative businesses most recently, I think, when it was in the 70s and 80s, because we're in contact with a gentleman who had a photography studio on the fourth floor all during the 70s and 80s. And that was the time when it was architects, and there were some graphic designers and things like that in it. But it's always been essentially an office building. I think through, you know, it got a bit of a reputation for being kind of a hippie hangout in the 70s and 80s, but always offices. The ground floor has always been retail. The corner was a bank originally, so the original entrance that is now on Wisconsin was the entrance only to that bank at the Wisconsin level, and you entered on Water Street to go into the building. That's since been reversed over time now, where it's private entrance off of water and the public entrance to the building is on Wisconsin.
How did what you did to the facade relate to how you went at the issue of what the inside of the building looks like?
Yeah, the inside, the only true historical parts that are left from the 1860s on the inside are the window casings on the north and on the west facade. So we're definitely keeping those. In the 1980s renovation, a lot of the original detail was taken out of the building. So going back into it, we're doing the renovation so that it's sympathetic to that time. It's not going to be a direct mimic of an 1860s building, but it's certainly going to have a lot more character that you're going from the outside. We have looked at photographs. We have some from 1969. There was an historic building survey done of this. The Historic American Building Survey came through. And those interior photographs showed original doors and transoms and some of the stairway details and banister details, things like that. So we've used those and we've taken those into account in doing our interior design.
The issue that strikes a lot of people now that they can see the full outside of the building, when you look at it, especially from Water Streets, it looks like, well, why did they only do half of the building?
Right. Yeah, agreed. I mean, it's an interesting progression, actually, from if you look at photographs from the 1860s to the 1870s, which I'm showing you. Obviously, people can't see. And then this photograph in particular, this is from 1917. So this shows after – in 1898, the building that was immediately south of the iron block burned down. And in doing so, it burned the roof off of the iron block. That was a time when they considered tearing it down. And they decided to put the addition onto it and rebuild would make more economic sense for the building. So in 1899, they put the Cream City Brick addition on the building. Now, it's interesting, you know, in looking at it, it seems to us that they got about six floors into the space of five floors over here because the third floor is perfectly level across the two buildings, but the second and fourth floor aren't. You step up or down depending on what floor you're on. So, and they certainly didn't try and mimic the detail other than running the cornice across in this lower cornice here, which we've called the water table. They ran those two across, but they made these out of sheet metal, not even the cast iron. So they didn't try and do any cast iron work. As you can see from the photograph, they completely changed the base of the building, got rid of the entrance on Water Street, and made it all shops and more of a solid corner than what it had been before. So in doing our renovation, too, it didn't make sense to sort of pretend that the addition didn't exist. Ideally, if we could have gone back to exactly the way that it was in 1860, that would have been our preference. But all of the cast iron on that corner now where FedEx is, that was all removed back when they put the addition on. So it had changed so much on the ground floor, plus the addition, that we really kind of straddled kind of a 1900, 1860 look. And that's why we decided then to do the whole base. Again, it was painted almost black at one time. We went back to that original kind of an olive green, if you will, color, and did our best to recognize the fact that the addition really was never meant to look like cast iron. It had been painted for probably the last 100 years, and we took all that off, and it is a beautiful Cream City brick. It's been sandblasted. It's been a little bit abused over time, but still the color of it, particularly with the color that we chose for the cast iron, I think is very sympathetic and actually goes very nicely. So we recognize the fact that it's a different part of the building.
As far as the original building goes, how do you expect it or want it to age?
Well, obviously we don't want it to rust. with a little bit of patina over time, the paint technology that was used this time around, it's a three-part system. So there's a zinc primer, and there's an aliphatic urethane that's a second coat, and then a fluorinar top coat. So it's been described as, you know, submarine technology, bridge painting technology. And I'll tell you, it is really – you can hardly scratch through it. So if we could keep it looking the way that it does today for the next 50 years, we'd be thrilled. It's obviously going to need a cleaning every so often. And if anything,
that's why I have a dental practice there.
Exactly. Dental practice will be outside once a year. And then anything that seems, you know, it's very, very hard to keep. There's so many pockets on this cast iron and little areas where water can get in. And, you know, and we tried to cover everything, but obviously if anything shows up, we'll be up there and we'll fix it. So.
The scaffolding is obviously off of the exterior. How much work is going on inside the building at this point?
We have all our permits, and all the National Park Service Department of the Interior is the one who regulates, because we're going for historic tax credits. We did on the outside. We're also getting historic tax credits for the inside. They've given us our approvals. The city's given us approvals. We're set to go, and probably within the next week and a half, you'll see that we'll be moving ahead on the interior.
I would imagine that not every dental company has its own in-house architects.
True.
How does this project compare to the kind of stuff that you're used to doing?
Well, this one is unique in that we're typically not doing what I would consider to be historic renovation. We do some renovation of buildings. In fact, one of the most recent ones we did was in Sturtevant, where we took an old Saturn car dealership and we turned that into a clinic. And people sometimes don't understand the scale of Dental Associates projects. For instance, the Franklin Clinic, too, that we just built was a ground-up building. It is very modern. You know, it's modern but warm. We're trying to make it an inviting place. And that was a 23,000-square-foot clinic, and it has 58 chairs in it. So they're pretty large-scale clinics. The Saturn dealership is a little smaller than that, but, you know, it was a an adaptation of an existing building, which actually was a neat project, too, because we inherited a lot of what obviously was there already, and I think that was very successful. This is very unusual in that it's of an historic nature, and that's not typically what we're doing. But this is our 11th building throughout the state of Wisconsin, and the other ones are undergoing renovation as well. They've been done in the early 1980s and up, so we're slowly going through and bringing everything up to kind of today's standards.
Maybe you've been asked this question before, but do you feel like at some level you've given this building a root canal?
Yeah, I guess you could say a root canal. Hopefully we've added more to it than we've taken away, like you would do in a root canal. But I've been told it's one of the most comprehensive restorations that's probably ever been done on a cast iron building. And really, that's congratulations to Tom Manos for agreeing to go ahead with it. I mean, some people might look and say, does that make economic sense? But really, this building is just such a jewel that it had to be saved. And there's really no other way to do it. There's not a whole lot of shortcuts that you could take on it.
Well, so do you mind sharing about how much this renovation has cost?
Well, the exterior is $1.6 million.
Which is a fair chunk of change, but a pretty remarkable result. Congratulations.
Well, thank you very much, Mitch.
Mark Dembski is the in-house architect for the Wisconsin-based Dental Associates. The company recently completed an exterior renovation of the Iron Block building, which it owns at the corner of Wisconsin Avenue and Water Street. The interior renovation will begin soon, and the building is slated to house the company's corporate headquarters and a dental clinic. You can see a slideshow of Iron Block building photos from WUWM.com/lake effect. One last break, and then what's behind the parallel plot of Milwaukee writer Jenny Benjamin's new novel, This Most Amazing? This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Teich. Milwaukee writer Jenny Benjamin's recent novel spans hundreds of years and thousands of miles. This Most Amazing is set in modern-day Milwaukee, but also in Italy, just before the turn of the 19th century. The book weaves together the mysteriously linked lives of a poet named Dahlia and a peasant named Vincenzo. The novel came out last month, and Jenny Benjamin came by the studio then to share the backstory. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Mitch.
Thanks for being here. Where did this novel start for you? I mean, a significant part takes place in Milwaukee, which is understandable, but where did your interest in Italy come from?
Well, I'm half Italian, and my family actually comes from the village that is the main setting in the novel. And so it originates from there, and a family story, actually.
So share the family story, if you wouldn't mind. What was it that captured your imagination and made you want to fictionalize it?
Well, it's a family story I heard a lot of times at family gatherings on my dad's side. That's the Italian side. And the story would go that my great-great-grandfather was in the army when Napoleon was coming in with his Italian campaigns, and just he and a few others got tired of fighting, so they just walked home to Valle di Brea, and that's the village. And then he was in jail, supposedly, and he met his future wife at the village jail because she brought the food. And that was the story that mystified me for years.
It's, well, and why wouldn't it? It grabs the imagination.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
The modern day part of the story does play out in part in Milwaukee, and your main character, modern day main character, is Dahlia, and she is a poet and a teacher as well. And I gather this is not too dissimilar from your own background?
Very similar, yes. Actually, all my writing – I've written fiction my whole life, but my first love with writing was poetry, and that's what I focused on when I got my master's. And always thought, well, I will publish a poetry book. It never happened. You have volumes unpublished in my drawers. But so, yes, and I'm also a teacher as well. I taught a high school for at-risk students for 11 years here in Milwaukee. And so I'm very close to it. I taught at MIAD at the college level, but and different venues for poetry too. So, yeah, the character is very similar. I've already gotten a lot of questions that I'm Dahlia because it's then that section that – part of the novel is first person, so – but I'm just as much Vincenzo as Dahlia, you know.
Well, I was going to ask, so at what point did you marry these two ideas in your mind and decide that they were actually one story?
Very good question. For years, I wrote poems about the story – the family story I told you about. And it would crop up in different narratives or different types of poems. It just all the time, I was fixated on it. And then it was after the birth of my third daughter – I was knocking around the Vincenzo part. I couldn't get it to work. And I was thinking it has to have two different time periods. What's going to be this connection? And then after Allie, my third daughter, was born, I got this idea of linking the two somehow. And Dahlia cropped up. And that's where she was born.
I'm always curious to talk about the process when it comes to a book that has a parallel structure like this. I mean, it plays out in modern day Milwaukee and then later modern day Italy, and then also at the same time, Italy during the Napoleonic Wars. Did your writing jump back and forth, or did you lay out each track individually and later weave them together?
That's a really good question. I wrote them simultaneously. And so when I outlined, I was very structured with this. Other things I'm not always know where I was leading. And so what you see now is divided up quite differently, but I would do these big chunks of Vincenzo and then a big chunk of Dahlia. And then once I finished those chunks, I would go back. So they were written at the same time.
Then the other question that goes along with process is you write as Dahlia for half the book and you write very knowingly as Vincenzo for mm-hmm. part of the book. Was it difficult for you to get into the mind of a male character?
That's a good question. It wasn't at all. He's so dear to me, and I don't know anyone, I think, who writes, that's part of the process, is that you do whatever you can to really get in the shoes of someone that you're writing about. And so whenever I did research or whenever I was imagining him in situations, I became him in a sense. Yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit more about Vincenzo. I mean, I think we have a thumbnail sketch of who Dahlia is at this point, but what makes Vincenzo tick?
Well, he's an artist, too. He grew up as a shepherd, as well. His family, they're shepherds outside of Valletta Brea, but he always drew, and his mother encouraged this. And then when he volunteers to go with the French to fight and acting like his brothers are not there.
Right. He volunteers essentially to save the rest of his family from getting conscripted into the French army.
Exactly. So that sacrificial move is very much in part of his character. But when it comes down to it, the actual, you know, fighting is difficult and it brings out a rage side, too, that he does have. He has that as well. So he's a really complicated character and very interesting to think about and to cast, you know.
Well, and the theme that crops up in both your Vincenzo character and in Dahlia is this idea of I think it's the wounded place inside them.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
Give us a sense for, I mean, there's the wounded place and then there are kind of the muses that both of them have in front of them.
Yeah, that's well put. Right. And I think with Vincenzo that wound, this doesn't give anything away because it's very much at the beginning of the book. The catalyst for him leaving and deserting is he broke off in the battle at Rivoli and chased down an Austrian boy, you know, and kills him just in the back. And it's a brutal scene and it tears him apart. It's his wound, and the rest of his journey is dealing with that. Now, Dahlia, it's a good question.
It's definitely more subtle.
It is more subtle, and you know, she speculates and has her whole theory. She's an interesting character too, in the sense of makes up her own theories and philosophies and kind of scripted together ideology. And some of it is that sometimes these wounds, these deep wounds, stay with us through various lives.
And we don't want to give too much away, but very early on in the book, I think the opening scene in the book, we learn that that Dahlia is somehow tapping into these experiences, yes, that Vincenzo had a couple centuries before.
Yes, and that is the opening scene that she basically, as the story goes on, and meeting, you mentioned her muse, if her love interest is Jonas, who is an artist, and those, that experience and that relationship ignites these scenes. She begins when she sleeps. She realizes these are not just dreams. These are recurring scenes from the life of this very specific person.
And I don't know whether we want to do we want to touch on Vincenzo's love interest? I mean, I guess we find out who it is,
yes,
in the beginning,
yes,
and we could certainly reference that that she is someone in this town that I don't know. How much do you want to say about Ottavia?
Ottavia is very much the story I had told you that was the catalyst of the story of my fictionalized version of the family,
sure,
story. She is the daughter of the village doctor, and she's the one bringing the food. Her cousin Paolo is the one keeping track of Vincenzo while he's in the cell, and Vincenzo falls instantly in love when he sees her.
How long have these characters been a part of your life?
Well, Vincenzo, the stories for, I can't even remember when I first heard the family story. But really me trying to write about it in poems goes back probably 10, 15 years. And then when I really got the idea to connect them, these two different timelines, that was since 2009. When I really started drafting it.
Given how long they have been with you, was it hard to end this book?
Yeah, I was happy to end it. Because you just get to where, you know, I always say this when I'm writing something. It took me, especially a poem, it took me 5 years and 5 minutes. And that kind of feeling of you, so much of it is just thinking and imagining and structuring over and over and over. So then when I actually got it, what I wanted to do and the story I wanted to tell, and I got it all mapped out, I was really happy to get that first draft done. And then, of course, there's the revision and stuff.
What was the hardest part of the process for you?
I think the hardest part was making sure that the two lines jived okay, and to run some themes throughout that would be an underlayer that could connect them as well. And that went through drafts because, like I said, when I wrote these huge chunks, that wasn't there. And it took in the revision process to really bring that bottom layer out.
And as you say, Dahlia is not, strictly speaking, an autobiographical character. Mm-hmm. But how different was Dahlia when you first conceived of the story and the Dahlia that actually shows up in the book today?
Well, I think in the very first version of her, she was a bit much, and I won't swear. But, she was kind of just too much, especially with Jonas and with her love interest, that she came off too harsh, too biting.
She does have her own rage that parallels in a strange way Vincenzo's, mm-hmm, although not a violent rage.
Exactly. And I was just thinking about that the other day when I was here. The characters are coming up in my head a lot more now as I'm talking about them. But they both do have world rage, which I think is very important in many ways for change, but also for them, you know, that connection to them. And it does. And it comes out, and she's not afraid to say it, and she's, a really alive character.
Well, what is your thinking about the idea of channeling experiences that have happened centuries before?
Well, I think that I'm very similar to Dahlia in this idea of, you know, are we a universe that trades lives or trades souls or things like that? And again, it comes back to having children. And after I had children and
well, you have kids too, or when they come out, it's like, wow, this is an old soul. That if you people may have said that or whatever, and looking at them and especially with each girl, I have three of them that came out, they looked like older and older souls. And just this idea of are we connected? And in our bodies, our DNA is connected very much to, you know, our ancestors too. So it really got me thinking and playing around with the characters and what happens in the story.
I'm curious, as I read the acknowledgments and everything around it, there must be a story to this. This book is published in Cyprus.
Yes, it is. There is a good story to this. You know, when you're submitting to – a lot of times you can go the agent route as a writer or small presses. You don't necessarily need an agent because they're more open to unsolicited manuscripts. And when I first started, I was done and I started pitching it to agents. I got a lot of responses that wanted to see it, but usually it came back with, you know, we don't know if we can sell this. And I really like this, but I don't like this. I can't take it on. And then I had a couple of close calls with smaller presses, and it just said to myself, maybe this is a small press book. So I really focused on smaller presses. And a friend of mine in my online writing group, Sandy Brawl, she on Twitter said, hey, Jenny, I saw that there's this press in the Mediterranean. Your book's set in the Mediterranean. You should send it to them. And that's how I found them. So, yeah, they're on Cyprus, and it's a pretty neat connection.
Did you have to do anything in particular to attract their interest? I mean, is there anything different about the publishing industry in Cyprus versus
You know, I think it was just they're very much into – believing in what they want to publish. If you look at their site, it's Armida Publications. They really have quite a variety on their list. And I think that, you know, if they connect to the story and they think there's a market for it, it's just like anything else. And I think the fact that it wasn't the Mediterranean, that might have had something to pull them in.
Was the time difference a challenge when it came to editing?
You know, it has been a little bit. But I'm a really early morning person, and with kids, you know, you get up beforehand, and so sometimes the best time they would be so surprised, they would send something. It's afternoon there, and it's maybe 4 or 5 a.m. for me. It's like, oh, here you are, you know. So it worked out.
Well, Jenny Benjamin, thanks so much, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much.
Jenny Benjamin's recent novel is called This Most Amazing. It's published by Armida Books. Benjamin is a freelance writer, poet, and teacher who lives in Milwaukee. There's a link to more about her and about her writing from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Our interview with Jenny Benjamin first aired in May. That's all for the Tuesday edition of the show. Just a reminder that our fiscal year is rapidly coming to an end. By sharing your support before our fiscal year ends this Sunday, you'll be among those that are helping to continue the quality news, information, and entertainment you rely on each day. Please make an important contribution today at wuwm.com/give or call us at 414-270-1225. And thanks so much for your support all year and every year. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks also for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.